And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Hi, Phil. Good.
Today we're going to talk to Sarah Flounders, who is going to be coming to town on Saturday, February 25th at 10:45 to 5 p.m. There's a conference that's organized by the Science for Peace. By the way, let's make sure we do this. Scienceforpeace.ca. Make sure you go to that website, start informing yourself. That's going to be on the February 25th. That's a Saturday at 10:45. The keynote speaker is going to be Sarah Flounders, and we're going to talk to her in just a few moments. And later, we're also going to Phil. You're going to report on a concert you attended.
In a movie theater.
Venezuela.
Very, very Venezuela. Amazing concert in Caracas, Venezuela. Yes.
The hook on this story is Phil knows a great deal about music. Is going to talk about what he's witnessed and what it might tell us about our commitment to civilization, culture. And then at the halfway point, we're going to talk to Rick Rozoff. He is the manager, I like that word, manager of StopNATO.com, and a very important website, and we're going to be talking with him. That will be about along about 5:30. But I think now we are joined by Sarah Flounders. Are you there, Sarah?
Yes, hi. I'm here. Hi, Phil.
Hi. We're really excited to know you're going to be coming to town on Saturday, February the 25th. And I guess it's titled a teach-in, and it's called The Geopolitics of War and Sanctions Against Iran. Now, I know, with the International Action Center, have been very active. You recently had demonstrations in, I think, 70 or 80 American cities. What are you addressing in these rallies? What is it that people need to know about this issue of sanctions and where it might lead?
Well, I think the biggest thing they need to know is that the danger is very real and is escalating. We need a whole new level of activation, of mass pressure, of being on the alert, because you hear the steady drumbeat in the background every day. The passage of the latest sanctions on Iran and the demand that every country in the world take part or themselves be sanctioned. That's an act of war in and of itself.
That's very coercive. I hadn't realized that's part of the language.
It's an ominous threat against every country's sovereignty. They have so long with this blockade.
Yeah, that is reminiscent. Of course, you now have a Democrat in the White House, but I remember when you had a Republican in the White House, he said, if you're not with us, you're against us.
That's right, and this really puts that into effect. Every country in the world, if they are involved in any financial transactions with Iran, has to end, has to stop buying oil, gas, other materials. So this is really impacting many, many countries, of course, more severely than the U.S., who does not have trade with Iran. So it's demanding all other countries actually harm themselves and harm their development. And it will also, of course, lead to an escalation in global oil prices. That impacts the poorest countries the most severely, those who depend on their purchases of oil and budgets that never balance. It leads to resulting increases in food prices and basic goods and cooking fuel and heating fuel and all of that. So it really is an attack on the people of the world, but it's meant to starve down and create dislocation in the Iranian economy. That's where it's aimed.
It certainly our front pages here trumpet that, or you know, almost sadistically talking about how they think they've really harmed them this time. Now the Iranians are going to be short of something, as though we're supposed to regard that as a triumph. But I think, as you laid out, I mean, actually, it's criminal to be doing that.
Right. It's absolutely criminal to be doing that. And they're measuring it. And as you say, they're applauding it on a daily basis. When Iran, a couple weeks ago, wasn't able to pay for a large shipment of rice, that was heralded as a tremendous thing. See the sanking.
Yeah.
life is becoming harder for people in Iran because of the sanctions. And it's always about sanctions. It's a direct attack on the civilian population, and particularly on the poorest, the neediest, those with the least resources, who, when prices go up, and also when a government that was providing certain basic things is suddenly the very force that's being bankrupted, then they're less able to do what they did previously, provide the subsidies and so on that they had. So it's very directly aimed at the poorest population, and it's meant to impose regime change, the idea being that if the pain is so great, people will rise up against their own government.
This is a, sort of the game plan they followed with the government of Iraq years ago, right?
That's right. And they set out to measure, calculate, and let the world know just how painful. You remember Madeleine Albright, famous quote, Secretary of State at the time, "The sanctions we think are worth it," when she was asked, "But it's led to the death of 500,000 children. Is that worth it?" She said, "Yes, the sanctions, we think it's worth it." It's no different today. That was a Democratic administration. But all of the reports at the time on Iraq from all different UN agencies and other international groups, that was never made a secret by the U.S. They never denied it. They wanted countries to fear their power and their ability to create such absolute dislocation in the economy of the country.
We're speaking to Sarah Flounders. She's going to be here in Toronto on Saturday, February 25th, 10:45 a.m. It runs through 5 p.m. It's a teach-in, Geopolitics of War and Sanctions Against Iran. Sarah, you raised the name of Madeleine Albright, and she once used an expression which I thought the Americans would drop from their vocabulary, at least in diplomatic parlance. She said that the United States is the one indispensable country. And that, the other night, I heard the President of the United States, Obama, use the exact phrase. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, are they losing their marbles? I mean, you're telling everybody, like, say, for example, Canada, you're dispensable.
Well, it is. This is the arrogance of power. And unfortunately, it infects all politicians in U.S. political life. They find themselves indispensable and the rest of the world entirely dispensable. And it is part of saying you're going to, demanding of other countries that you go along with this, that you support this blockade, you support this act of war, and all of the other plans that go with it. Because what makes it so dangerous is as this becomes acceptable, the whole world is involved, supposedly, in this blockade and starving Iran down. Then, whether it's through a deliberate provocation or a miscalculation or a staged, you know, false flag operation, regardless of how it begins, a real war, an outbreak of a military clash is also entirely possible.
Yes,
and that's a danger because you've already created the climate and had all of these other countries involved in the surrounding and encirclement of Iran and in committing this crime against the people of Iran.
It seems to me, the language is such, as you outlined it, that if a state lifts its hand in self-defense, that becomes an offense.
That's right.
Anything
that's
right. They do.
That's right. Now, a number of countries have refused to go along with it right off the bat, both China and Russia, and then India, all have said that they would not abide by this blockade. And of course, Iran has responded that if the European Union initiates this within 6 months, what was entirely possible, they will cut them off beforehand. In other words, why should they allow Europe to do this at their convenience and at preparation? So you see, it becomes more and more hardball.
Where they challenge the state to actually defend it. So,
yeah,
it's a classic sort of schoolyard bully situation,
right,
where he's pushed or a line is drawn or he's insulted. This is Sarah Flounders. I want to ask too about this. Today's headline, the Star is here, Toronto Star, is that tensions are mounting because there is a visit to Iran by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And I know you've discussed that in your articles and speeches. Talk about the role that is being played here by that agency.
Well, that agency, which had some little bit of independence previously under al-Baradei, is now all but in the pocket of the U.S. With their inspections and their reports. Mm-hmm. Although even the IAEA has said, the International Atomic Energy Agency has said, that they can find no evidence that Iran is building nuclear weapons. Now, they should know, because as in Iraq, Iran is under, they put themselves, they're being monitored all the time. It's not like it's just a visit of a few officials.
Mm-hmm.
There's cameras, there's all kinds of observance of every industrial site where nuclear energy is being developed. All kinds of things are measured as to what's being produced and the speed of the centrifuges and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you can sneak this in. Iran has the capacity to refine uranium to 20%. Weapons grade is more than 90%. So there's a huge gap there,
mm-hmm.
Even between Iran's capacity for now and years into the future. And yet, if you ask anyone on a street corner in the U.S., I don't know what it's like in Canada, if you asked anyone who has nuclear weapons in the world today or who has nuclear weapons in the Middle East, they'll tell you Iran. They won't think to say, oh, the U.S. has hundreds of them, or Israel has more than 200, some say 500. Will not be the first thing that comes to their mind, because they're hearing again and again that Iran is a threat and their nuclear weapons are the threat. The fact that they have none and no ability to make them now or into the foreseeable future is lost in the constant drumbeat of coverage and politician statements, mm-hmm. and so on.
You may have seen that there is a satirical paper produced in the U.S. called Onion, and they ran, mm-hmm. a photograph of a missile last week, and they said that Iran is becoming concerned that it's possible that the U.S. may be developing its 8,950th bomb, and it could happen at any moment.
Right, I
saw it sort of captures the problem, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does, because it puts it's gallows humor, given the planet. But that's the reality of it. There's, mm-hmm. Iran without a nuclear weapon, and the U.S. demanding this monitoring and inspecting, and actually providing all sorts of nuclear material to other countries. Their latest deals with India are to accelerate and accentuate all of this.
And by the way, am I right? Is India a signatory to the International Atomic Energy Agency, or Pakistan? They both have nuclear weapons.
Right. As I understand it, they're not. But I'm not sure of that.
But they make this a comedy. Now, of course,
Israel is not a signer and has never allowed any inspections, and it's absolutely no doubt. You could actually look at Iran surrounded by nuclear weapons, whether it's, mm-hmm. U.S. aircraft carriers and nuclear subs, or India, Pakistan, Israel,
Mm-hmm. Well, now, and indeed, we are being treated again to, you probably see these same headlines, maybe more of them, but today's paper is whether the U.S. is restraining Israel from an attack on Iran. As though they're doing a good deed by holding back Israel. What do you make of that particular exercise in political, I don't know what word for it, but propaganda? But is this whole thing about the U.S. and Israel arguing?
Well, it's a lot like somebody endlessly feeding a pit bull or another attack dog and saying at any moment, I'm so afraid my dog is going to attack you, while it's kept on leash. It's the U.S. who at every moment has provided for more than 60 years billions of dollars in equipment and credit and loans and aid to Israel, who could not survive a day without this continuing financial and military support.
So their ability to restrain is pretty good.
This would be this idea that they're the threat. Israel is the threat, when, of course, Israel couldn't carry out any attack or even have overflight into Iran without U.S. authorization. Couldn't have the weapons, the planes, the aircraft, the radar, without the U.S. providing it. And that the U.S. is at every moment trying to restrain Israel. It's out of touch. It's a complete lie. The question is what form they might use for an attack. Will it come directly from the U.S. or will it come from Israel?
This is Sarah Flounders, and she's going to be at the University of Toronto teaching the geopolitics of war and sanctions against Iran. That's going to be Saturday, February 25th at 10:45. And it's scienceforpeace.ca is sponsoring. Sarah, I have to ask you, of course, the link about the Syria thing seems to be truly escalating from day to day in terms of maneuvering by the Gulf monarchies and the United States and others. Is this related to the Iran question, or is this just like a sort of a second front for them?
Well, it's very related, and it is a second front. A lot of this is all connected also to the U.S. losing its position in the region based on the complete disaster of its war in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And so there is an effort to regroup, recapture what they've lost, what they also lost with the downfall of Mubarak. And by consciously destabilizing Syria with both militias, arms, all kinds of sabotage consciously used, and also funding and supporting opposition groups within Syria, which exist. But in order to destabilize the Syrian government and also push hard, they pushed hard for a UN resolution. They had a Russian and Chinese veto. They wanted to do exactly the kind of war that they carried out in Libya just in the past year, and we saw what a horrendous disaster it was for Libya.
Yeah, it's just become living a disaster with no end,
with the water, with the food processing, with the infrastructure all laid waste. And the only thing that they'll brag about is, well, the pumping of oil seems to be back online. That's what they care about. And even that's a question.
That's the good news.
Syria,
the oil will flow.
In Syria, what they're trying to do is change. Syria plays a very important role in the balance in the entire region. And their assistance to Palestinians, to Lebanese, for decades, there's a big stake in trying to turn that. And so the use both of sabotage coming in from Israel, coming in from Iraq, coming in from Turkey, from every direction, and it is absolutely destructive in Syria. It's more dangerous, and it's also being done very consciously with the Gulf monarchies. These are completely corrupt feudal regimes. There's no
democracy. Vanguard of reform in the region.
Right. This whole idea of the Arab League issuing pronouncements and the Gulf Coordination Council and whatnot. Who is that? Who is it led by? Saudi Arabia. No democracy there. Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates. Every one of these are monarchies. where there is no democracy whatsoever, the most brutal forms of repression going on right now,
mm-hmm.
right now against the mass movements, and yet they will make proclamations, take them to the United Nations, and it's all treated as if this is a peace mission.
Just,
it's an incredible
story.
Right.
This is Sarah Flounders. And, Sarah, we're very grateful you took the time to talk to us, and we look forward to seeing you on Saturday, February 25th.
Thanks so much. That's this Saturday, right.
It's
right.
Coming up, and a teach-in on geopolitics of war and the sanctions against Iran. Look forward to seeing you.
Thank you, Phil. All bye-bye. Right.
Bye-bye. That's Sarah Flounders, and she will be here in the city. She's going to be at the teach-in that's going to be Saturday 25th, and I'll get the details. Sydney Smith Hall, room 2102, University of Toronto, 100 St. George. Everybody knows locally. We just come to University of Toronto, 1045. By the way, there will be an admission, a donation, $10. And this is a teach-in you're going to want to support. And other speakers include Mohammed Tavakoli Targi of the University of Toronto, Victoria Tamasebi at the University of Toronto, Shadi Chasturi, York University. Eve Engler is going to be there. Eve has a new book. We interviewed him about that book, and it is a terrific book about the false reputation Lester Pearson has as a peacemaker. It is out, and we'll talk about that further. But Eve Engler is going to be there on Saturday, the 25th at 10:45, and that's University of Toronto, Sydney Smith Hall, room 2110. Yakov Rabkin of the University of Montreal is going to talk about Israel and Russia, and Robert Latham, York University. Global Networks of Power will be his subject. So it's quite a lineup, and Sarah is going to be the keynote speaker. And so we look forward to it. It's an important event. I think are we going to take a break first? Phil, you are going to tell us about something you attended. Toronto and
in a movie theater on Saturday afternoon, and this is linked up by satellite. And while I was in that theater, there were 500 theaters in North America, and I am told thousands in South America and in every television in Venezuela. And what it is was a concert of the symphony that Gustav Mahler wrote that is called the Symphony of 1,000, because literally you can put 1,000 performers. In this case, it was 1,200 performers on stage. And the music director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic is a 29-year-old Venezuelan named Gustavo Dudamel. And how did a kid become the leader of this prestigious orchestra? Well, because he comes out of El Sistema. And El Sistema is the government program in Venezuela that predates Chavez, but which has been supported beyond all imagination since Chavez became the president. And
so he funded a good idea.
He it was already going, and it's interesting because people say, well, they're not pluralistic. The guy who founded it and who runs it, who was an educator, is actually part of the liberal opposition. He was once a cabinet minister in pre-Chavez days. But he gets along fine with President Chavez because they all agree on this program. Every child in Venezuela, but especially every child in poor neighborhoods, learns a musical instrument in this program. And it is not funded through the educational ministry. It's funded through the social services ministry.
You cannot find that here. Go ahead.
No, you cannot. Well, you can't find that anywhere.
They will take a violin away from you if they catch you with one.
Don't joke. Mike Harris did that. He did take violins away from students all over Ontario, and Dalton McGuinty hasn't given them back.
I think his position was, if I can't make music, you can't.
Well, that's right. Don't forget, he did put a high school dropout in charge of education, right? I mean, that was one of his accomplishments.
Revenge.
This program, of course, and of course the inevitable is happening because it's been around now for 25 years, which is that all of a sudden Venezuela is flooding the world with top-grade musicians. I mean, you can't take an entire nation, train everybody on an instrument, and not start producing great, great musicians. But what I love about it, of course, is it has taken classical music out of the hands of the elite, who like to dominate it to show how more civilized they are, and given it back to the people who really have a right to enjoy it. I'm sure Gustav Mahler, who himself came from very, very humble origins, would have been very, very happy to have seen this. There were 1,000 choristers on the stage. Almost wow. entirely, they were young people. You could see on the screen there was a handful of like adults, right? Really, you know, they must have been the teachers because there'd be like one every 20 or 30 people. There was a children's chorus of 200 that was all kids from Caracas. Who sang, by the way, their music without any notes. They sang entirely from memory, right? And I got to say, note perfect, by the way. I mean, I know this piece, and it would be very easy to mess it up. Nobody messed it up. It was even the New York Times, in their great snobbishness, had to admit this was an outstanding performance. Mm-hmm. On the stage were two full orchestras, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and the Simon Bolivar National Orchestra, which is for the most part made up of young orchestra musicians who came out of this program. And Dudamel interspersed them with each other so that everybody was sitting next to a member of the other orchestra. There was a nice little feature
that
went with it.
That's impressive to watch.
That really was impressive to watch. And how much the musicians really loved it. I have to say that.
What's the venue for you to see this? Is this just on your television?
No, this was at one of the local cineplexes. You went
it's
down.
A live performance.
It was a live performance.
Wow.
And actually, they only put it into Canadian theaters the past week. They weren't going to put it in Canadian theaters, and I guess that there was some interest expressed, and they set it up quickly. It wasn't very well publicized. My understanding is that there were 500 theaters in the U.S. where people were watching this. To see these kids, to see how much they loved this, how good they are at it, and of course, the camera lingered after the end of the performance on the kids as they were – by the way, to get 1,000 people off the stage takes 20 minutes, right? So the camera lingered through that period,
too. If you organize.
Right. Yeah. And even that was the most wonderful thing to watch. They panned the audience. And I'm expecting a big event like this where all the stuff shirts are going to be there. But, of course, there's no stuff shirts. I mean, these people were very ordinary-looking Venezuelans. Well, that's because they sold the ticket over the counter. No scalpers. No, just show up. First person.
No stuff shirts?
No, yeah. They didn't control the tickets, which was a very democratic way of performing it. You know, obviously, only a fraction of people could be there who actually wanted to be there, but they made sure it wasn't dominated.
You mean by that there's only so many seats?
Of course. Yeah. It's a concert hall. I do want to say this about Professor Abroy, who is the guy who founded this thing, and Dudamel himself comes out of this program. He's 30 now. He started in this program when he was 5. He's from a poor family. They actually showed in the promotional material the school in the community where he comes from, and they showed some small children wearing white gloves while they were singing in a choir. And the kids wearing the white gloves are special needs kids, including deaf kids. And so one of the people from L.A., one of the musicians asked, well, at what point do you realize that some kid just doesn't have it, and when do you take them out of the program, and how do you like promote all this excellence and stuff like that? And he says, you know, when I asked the question, they didn't understand it. And so the answer is nobody is taken out of this program, right? This is for every school kid in Venezuela, and they stay with it. Now El Sistema has been spread to the penitentiary system in Venezuela as well. So they're going to take the entire prison population and start training them in music like this.
Oh.
Because the theory is
– That is brilliant.
If you can learn to cooperate, to play in an orchestra, you would learn not to ever be antisocial.
Well, by the way, it's rather consoling to be able to make music.
Of course.
I think it's biblical, right? Yeah. If you want to prevent violence, you introduce music.
And, you know, I want to say something about this professor – Abroy, who, again, I emphasize, is a middle-of-the-road politician, not a supporter of the regime, at least not initially. He is a national hero in Venezuela, and he's an educator. And I was, like, racking my brains. When is the last time we had a national hero in Canada or the United States who is a national hero because they're an educator? You know, and I can't answer that question. I don't know who would be. Who would we be talking about, right? You know, maybe some of the founders of early universities, but, you know, maybe in the 19th century. But, I mean, where do we honor educators in Canada? So, anyway, that's my review of El Sistema.
El Sistema, great. Is it, just give me one tip on before we go on. Is there a follow-up? Where would somebody go to learn more about that?
Well, there's a great Wikipedia article on El Sistema, spelled S-I-S-T-E-M-A, and it's a very fair article. It's very balanced, and it's very thorough. So I would recommend you start there, and then that will lead you into a lot of links, so you can learn a lot more about it.
Well, thanks, Phil Conlon. You heard it here. We're going to take a little break for the Taylor Report and be right back.
We are over 4,200 education workers at U of T. We have been trying to negotiate a fair collective agreement for 10 months. We are asking for smaller labs and tutorial sizes, for more work opportunities and financial assistance for upper year graduate students, and to be paid for all the work that we do. We teach, we learn, we explore, we are the university.
We are the University of Toronto Education Workers, QP Local 3902.
From the roots up. CIUT 89.5 FM, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. From Heart House, University of Toronto.
And we're back. This is the Taylor Report. CIUT 89.5 FM. And you can always write to us, Taylor at CIUT.fm. We'd love to hear from you. And we have a website for if you want to hear previous programs, Taylor-report.com. And shortly we're going to talk to Rick Rozoff. I understand Rick is under the weather today, but he's bravely going to make time. And we're going to find out what StopNATO.com is featuring. And to get his thoughts on the same topic that we were speaking with Sarah Flounders about, which is how dangerous the war threat is, what type of threat, and some of the remarkable things that you can find at this website. And I think we are joined by Rick Rozoff. Are you there, Rick?
Yes, I am, Bill. Hello.
Thanks very much for joining us. I know you're a little under the weather, but we love to hear from you. I was following your site, and you've had a number of really fascinating articles here recently. And one of them is an article published in Pakistan, which is taking comments from the Canadian paper, the Ottawa Citizen, which is quite a revelation. I had not known the Citizen published that, but since I went to StopNATO.com, I found out about it. And the writer was talking about what has happened here. What actually went down in Libya as opposed to what the official line was. And that raises, I guess, the two questions. One, about the quality of reporting, but are we now witnessing, do you believe, in Syria, maybe a similar storyline?
Yeah, I fear so. And just as I imagine many of your viewers, most of them, I assume yourself and me, had an inkling of an idea that something quite like was the Ottawa Citizen revelation document. I should manage the article from the Pakistan newspaper, the Pakistan Observer. It's really kind of a survey of several Western newspaper accounts, also one from the leader. I don't know where that newspaper is.
Yes, Regina.
And oh, is it really?
Also,
the leader post.
Yeah.
And it confirms what there had been limited reports of during the war against Libya last year, but I consolidate the information that had been available. Meaning, in other words, that as I think we're right in assuming that something quite in parallel with that is occurring in and against the government of Syria right now, that the consolation we'll have is 6 or 8 months after that debacle is consummated, then we'll be able to find out the real truth of what governments did. And this is these are in countries like Canada and the United States that, thump their chests boasting about their free and independent media and so forth, news media and so forth.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Rick Rozoff. He is a manager of the site, very important one, StopNATO.com. And, Rick, there is this developing confrontation, and it's sort of it's almost competing crises that they're being manufactured here, one towards Syria, the other the nuclear issue around Iran, both of them involving the possibility of intervention and force. I think when you paint the picture that I get from Stop NATO, This also involves the two most famous Security Council members now, China and Russia. Tie those together a bit for us. What's going on in your view?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, Phil, because that's a connection or interpretation that doesn't immediately leap to mind. And, however, after some looking into the issue, I think it becomes obvious that the General Assembly vote on Syria and the Syria resolution introduced by Western powers and their Gulf Cooperation Council allies in the Persian Gulf last Thursday is, of course, nominally and directly aimed at Syria and the government of the country, but no less so. And one can argue maybe to a certain extent even more so, it's aimed at both isolating, humiliating, tarring the reputation of both Russia and China, which, as you know, earlier this month, had only the second time in the history of the United Nations Security Council issued a double veto on the issue of Syria both times, this month and last mm-hmm. autumn. So having gone out on a limb, quite a bit, to be slapped down with an overwhelming vote in the General Assembly, non-binding as it is, but in terms of the Court of International Public Opinion and so forth, I believe that vote was designed more than anything else to weaken the international status of Russia in the first place, China in the second.
In other words, the motion was designed as a device to isolate Russia, China, to basically embarrass them.
Right, and there have been several analyses to that effect in the Russian online press, as you might imagine. Mm-hmm. And one of a couple of days ago suggested the immediate tie-in was the March 4th presidential election in Russia, and that if Russia's can be its image can be tarnished by supporting alleged genocide and scoffing or rebuffing the opinion of world humanity and such like, mm-hmm. then we've set the stage for the accusation that their elections, of course, are in keeping with that, and that they will, dismiss the opinions of its own populace. Russia will dismiss the opinions of its own populace as readily as it will that of the world community and so forth. The West, the United States in the first place, is not without some ability to conduct effective public relations around the world, as we know,
mm-hmm.
In reference to what this conversation began with, the fact that, for seven solid months last year, the Ottawa Citizen and the Leader Post and the Washington Post and the New York Times and all the other essentially house organs of the Western powers were churning out the same copy and paste analyses of what was going on in Libya. And of course it was entirely enforcing a fly zone to protect Libyan civilians from the mm-hmm. Depredations of the Gaddafi regime and so forth. So we'll find out after the fact what we suspected at the time, which is essentially not true.
It's amazing what the Ottawa Citizen revealed. The Ottawa Citizen interviewed Canadian officers who said they boarded a vessel of the Benghazi rebels who was loaded down with arms. They told their captain he's loaded down with arms, and he said, "We'll check with headquarters," and then said, "Let them go." That's amazing. I mean, that.
And then keep in mind the Canadian ship is in the Charlottetown and so forth. Canadian naval forces with their NATO allies are in the area to enforce the naval blockade on arms.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just so wretchedly, grotesquely, darkly, if you will, humorous.
Mm-hmm. It's the only medicine I know.
Yeah.
We should be laughing in their face. I mean, when they tell us things, we ought to say, "Boy, you are a joker." Yeah,
right.
I don't know
right.
how else to defend myself.
No, and often, unlike the feature in the Pakistani newspaper, online newspaper we're talking about, which I think did a good job of analyzing the content of two major Canadian dailies revelations,
mm-hmm.
All too often even people who attempt to be opponents of war and military intervention around the world will give backhanded credence to the very propaganda sources of justifying the military action, by quoting them mm-hmm. reverently, mm-hmm. with veneration. So, if you quote the New York Times, you've established credibility yourself or something. I would argue it's the mm-hmm. opposite. But we do have to increasingly start exposing and debunking, the news sources rather than simply passing on their comments unexamined.
Yes. By the way, Rick, I believe you made a comment, it may have been just been preparing this program. You said that the vote at the United Nations you thought was reminiscent of at the time, I believe, Carter was the president. They managed over Afghanistan to get this kind of vote Soviets were there.
Yeah, that was a striking parallel to me. When I saw the results of the vote, actually I came home from work on last Thursday, and in the interim between leaving work and getting home, I had a phone call from a Pacifica radio station asking if I could do an interview on the General Assembly, a vote about which I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And when I went online to read the results and saw the lopsided vote, it's 137-4, 12 against, 17 abstentions, it reminded me immediately of the vote taken in early January of 1980 on the initiative of the Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew-Brzezinski administration, which was meant to isolate and humiliate Russia's predecessor at that time, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And the vote at that time, as I recall, was 107 for the resolution condemning the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan to 18 countries voting against. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely similar. I don't know of anything in the interim that is comparable to that, at least anything initiated by Western powers. Mm-hmm. But it's also, Bill, that we have to look at, sometimes it's painstaking, and it's not information that immediately crystallizes in our mind. But as you know, on the NATO site, we frequently quote from U.S. military websites, which are public relations, U.S. Air Force in Europe, or Navy Newsstand, or whatnot. But these are the sources where you really get information about the extent and the nature of U.S. military partnerships around the world. And I recall one about a graduating class at the U.S. Army School in Leavenworth that listed, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was something like graduates of 110 countries, and they listed the nations. So when you see a vote come up 137-12 in the General Assembly, that really isn't all so surprising.
A lot of them were trained at Fort Leavenworth. Yeah.
right, exactly. The militaries were integrated through U.S. dominance of international lending institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And so for the U.S. has a lot of leverage over particularly small and impoverished countries.
Yeah, you cite an interesting source. You have I think it's a U.S. military magazine, was involving a theory about how they might destabilize the area of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran by trying to create Baluchistan.
Yeah.
And your sources are all U.S. military guys.
I'm laughing a little bit wryly, perhaps, but this is where you go. It's the Chicago bankster, pardon me, I'm being out of time. The Chicago bank robber, if you recall, almost a century ago, and asked why he robbed banks, he said, because that's where the money is. and I think we have to realize, if you want to know, with U.S. so-called soft power with the State Department, of USAID and so forth, but hard power with the military, what they're up to, then there are no independent reporters who have access to this information. You really need to get it from military sources, but I know what you're talking about, the hearings held in the U.S. Congress Committee on Foreign Relations, chaired by Donna Rohrabaugh.
Yes, the Republican senator. They're developing a plan for seeing if they could create an independent phenomenon there so that the U.S. would have broader, easier access to the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, they would have they could ship material to Baluchistan and then overland directly into Pakistan. They wouldn't be dependent on the Pakistani government.
If I hadn't read the StopNATO.com, I wouldn't have known that the Gwadar port existed. I didn't know about it.
Yeah, it's a major undertaking by China, of course, and an access point or a port for bringing Persian Gulf oil into Baluchistan and from there through Pakistan to China. So, I mean, these are pretty high-level geopolitical moves. We have to remember there's a sister province on the other side of the Iranian border, Sistan Baluchistan, and that if separatist activities are heated up in the Pakistani side, they would inevitably, as they have to some extent already, spill over into the Iranian.
Exactly. And I never quite understood what was involved there. I didn't get as clear a picture until I read StopNATO.com and that article, which is a very recent one, by the way. We're speaking to Rick Rozoff, and I know he's under the weather, but I'm going to ask one last thing of you, Rick, if we could. Today's Toronto Star is talking about how the Arctic Ocean is actually becoming an ocean. That is, now there's more water than before. And the article says we have to build up our navy and we have to assert our sovereignty. How much sovereignty does Canada – what's your understanding of the sovereignty issue there? Because I know there are other players, Denmark, Russia, the United States. What's that about?
Well, there are several contested areas. As to the Northwest Passage, so-called, I mean, I think that's fairly incontestably Canada's, though its prime ally, the United States, does contest that and insists it's an international waterway. So, yeah, that conflict.
So their real problem would be with the U.S. if they're arguing about it.
Yeah, also with the Beaufort Sea, which the U.S. through Alaska makes claims to territories simultaneously claimed by Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the eastern side, of course, you have Denmark and Canada in dispute over the island and so forth. But all being NATO nations, those disputes don't mean anything. They have a common...
Yeah, so they talk about Russia.
Against Russia.
So that is quite remarkable. In terms of the challenge to actual Canadian sovereignty, there are legal challenges coming minimally from the U.S. and I think you said Denmark?
Yeah, Denmark.
But they want to talk about Russia instead.
Yeah, exactly. And,
because we don't have a nuclear weapon.
No, but it's been going on since January of 2009, actually. The outgoing, at that time, George W. Bush administration issued the National Security Council directive on the Arctic, where it reiterated the claim that the Northwest Passage is an international waterway, and that the U.S. reserved the right to station military there, including interceptor missile ships, the sort that are now proliferating around the Mediterranean and will soon be land-based in Eastern Europe. It's the Ellesmere Island, is it not? Hans Island in the east that are being contested between Denmark and Canada. But there's an exercise that may have just ended, Arctic Ram, in the north, the high north, with over 1,000 Canadian troops. And the coverage in the Canadian press is, repeatedly, referred to it as, in a post-Afghanistan situation, Canada's developing its combat capabilities for the Arctic. And I think we should remember with the annual Operation Nanook exercises that occurred during the summer, they were just started at exactly the point a few years ago, not too many years ago, where Russia renewed its territorial claims in the Arctic. But for the last 2 years, Canada was not alone. It conducted those military, of increasingly larger dimensions, of course, conducted those military drills with their NATO allies, the United States and Denmark. That is, which is to say, the very two countries that have actual territorial disputes with Canada are invited in for joint military activities that can only be aimed at Russia.
Boy, that is a very clear picture. Rick, we're very grateful you took the time. We know you're a little under weather. We wish you well, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Yeah, I'm always honored to have the opportunity. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Talk to you soon. That's Rick Ruzoff. Rick, he's the manager of StopNATO.com, which is a wonderful site. And it's kind of interesting, eh, Phil?
That is. I mean, I guess we all got to get our cold weather fighting gear ready, right?
Yes.
We're going to go out there in the tundra. We're going to defend our sovereignty against the Russians.
Remind me how many long-range missiles we have. No, I'm sorry. And how many nuclear? No. We have a big friend. But the big friend is the one who says that we don't have sovereignty.
Right.
That's interesting.
We're dispensable.
Funny you should mention. Well, it's a great story. And I, by the way, I could tell you we read the Star today, and I didn't. That isn't the spin they put on it. That is not the spin they put on it. Phil, do you have an announcement? I think there's
and a very interesting event is this
cultural event.
This Friday evening, Gilad Atzmon, who is a jazz musician and an author, he is an Israeli who's living in London, England, and he has written a book called The Wandering Who, which is a very clever title. And the event is in promotion of the Global March to Jerusalem, which will be a worldwide event, but especially with a lot of staging areas in cities near Jerusalem. It's going to occur on March 30th. This event is this coming Friday night, February 24th at 7 p.m. at the Islamic Center of York Region, 1380 Stouffville Road in Richmond Hill. The admission is $10, which for dinner and a lecture, that's a pretty good price.
Yeah, but here's a internationally recognized musician.
He's an internationally recognized musician.
And an instrument is a saxophone, right?
That's right. That's right. And he's the author of The Wandering Who. But he's coming to Toronto to promote the Global March to Jerusalem on March the 30th. So again, 7 p.m. this coming Friday evening at the Islamic Center of York Region, 1380 Stouffville Road in Richmond Hill. Admission is $10. Yeah. And that's at 7 p.m.
And by the way, I mentioned Eve Engler, and of course he's going to be Saturday. Eve Engler is going to be one of the panelists, and the keynote speaker is Sarah Flounders. It's a teach-in, The Geopolitics of War and Sanctions Against Iran. That is Saturday, February 25th, beginning at 10:45 a.m., running to 5 p.m., sponsored by scienceforpeace.ca. And Eve Engler is part of that program. I'll just say Sydney Smith Hall, 2102, room 2102, University of Toronto. Of course, that's 100 St. George, scienceforpeace.ca. And another Engler note is he's going to be on March the 6th. He's going to be at McMaster University at Gilmore Hall with his new book, the one we talked to him about sometime back. And so these are all people are stirring around, and they better, as based on what Sarah Flounders and Rick Rossoff has been saying, you better stir around if you want to be stirring. Another matter that we want to make sure that we speak up, because this is the point about this gentleman, is that very little international press is directed toward his story. But Qadar Adnan is in his 63rd day of a hunger strike. He's picked up by Israeli soldiers. He is a member of a Palestinian organization, though never charged. He's a baker by profession, 33 years old. He was taken in, and he, of course, is not. No one knows what he's charged with. He's being held, and he has refused to eat. Obviously, he's in danger of losing his life. I understand Irish organizations have begun to organize in the memory of Bobby Sands. You go on the internet, and you'll find people singing songs to him. And in Canada, his name is not mentioned. There's a very good article by Max Blumenthal in Al Akbar, the English edition, and he makes a point that there is a gentleman named Chaim Perlman who has been guilty of several violent assaults on Palestinians, including a stabbing. He was held for a number of days and without charges and whatnot, and an Israeli judge saw fit to release him, ordered him released. This is the 63rd day of a hunger strike of a man who has not had any charges placed against him. And he is in danger of losing his life. Many websites and others are talking about him. Mondo Weiss, you know the website Mondo Weiss with two S's. I recommend you go to that site. They are talking about this. And, of course, they're interested in the fact that the Western media takes no interest in this Palestinian. And, of course, the angry Arab is talking about it, and that's why he is angry. He says this is always the way. If it's a Palestinian, it's treated second, third class, and certainly not anything to get alarmed about, no matter what the pain or the suffering of that person. I do recommend, too, that you go to the Mondo Weiss site. You have to do a little looking on the site because as days move on, but they've been following a debate, which I was unaware of, maybe Phil was, but I think we mentioned on this show that a little argument has broken out between Norman Finkelstein and the boycott, BDS, boycott, what are the other letters? Yeah, I know sanctions is one.
Yeah.
And for some reason, Norman Finkelstein decided to make an issue with, have an issue with them. Actually, I don't mind a good brawl. I mean, everybody learns. You get a chance to hear what everybody's discomforted about. I know it turns on the issue of should anybody raise the issue of how about a one-state solution, which, by the way, was the position of Edward Said in his dying days. He said, I give up. The two-state thing has just become a song and dance. It's justifying the Palestinian political class that is now totally seconded by the U.S., which pays their bills, and they pay their bills by giving the money to Israel, who then decides whether to hold it back. And they so they got their hat in their hand, and they have no state. But at any rate, there's a great deal of frustration. The BDS people who've been very successful with many of their actions, I suppose, are a little surprised.
Finkelstein, when he spoke in Toronto last month, he didn't mention this controversy with this group, but he did argue against the one-state solution, and he's using a very, very pragmatic approach to politics. I'm not sure I agreed with him, but I was glad to hear the perspective put forward and his justification for it. We should remember, though, that back in the day, right, when this issue first came to public attention, the demand of the PLO was for a single, secular, democratic state in the area of what is now called Israel and the occupied territories. And that idea, of course, is considered horrifying by the Zionists because it involves rule of law and democratic rights and equality of all citizens.
Well, then the right of return.
The right of return, of course.
And by the way, all the Palestinians say this. This is really where there's a nub. See, and the angry Arab and others, I'm going to call him that. I learned his name, but I just love to call him the angry Arab. So he's pointing out, he says, you know, this is our business. We're the Arabs. We're the Palestinians. This is for us. And it's nice that you have opinions. Mm-hmm. He says, by the way, his 2 cents worth is he doesn't agree with Finkelstein. He said, but he loves the guy. He says he's a hero, and quite rightly, as he found himself saying today, I've paid my dues, said Finkelstein. Mm-hmm. He certainly has. He's suffered. But, you know, this is an argument. Everybody has a right to have their say. And he made this point, you know, ultimately we decide this. And if Mr. Anybody, whether it's Yasser Arafat or this other fellow, Mazim, I forget his name, okay, they say, you're not going to give our rights away. It's not yours to give. So, you know, be careful about all this heavy advice to us. So it is a beneficial essay. I can't resist the joke because it's come up now. That there have some, it's gotten sharp and a little personal, and there have been some people who say that he's making, that Norman Finkelstein has been making a Dershowitz of him himself. Some of this saying what you could talk about, what you can't talk about, and becoming the one who knows how, you know, whether it just seems like an error he's gotten himself into is saying what will fly. Mm-hmm. Frankly,
right,
this world, I meet a lot of people who think they know stuff, including me, but nobody knows what's going to fly. Tell it to the Wright brothers.
Well, and by the way, if the Israelis want to look at history, the United States is a single state solution. The idea of a black nation within the United States, which was once talked about, of course, disappeared. Yeah. The idea that there was going to be a state of Southern slave owners separate from the rest of the country, that didn't work either, did they?
No. You know,
and by the way, South Africa is a single state.
Well,
right?
As a matter of fact, you bring us to the great charge that now in the 20th century they want us to use, which is so-and-so is killing his own people. Yeah. And usually if it's Obama talking or Sarkozy, he means that killing your own people is his job. He'll kill your own people for you. And then, but the other thing is, I think we should answer, you mean he's Lincoln-esque? Yeah. Because there were 500,000 Americans were killed. Yeah. So they were killing their own. And there were some people, you know, like the French said, we'll help you out, we'll come. And the British said, we'll help you out, we'll come. And America said, you come near us and there will be a war. But anybody, you know, Assad could never say that. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to sit there with his knee on the ground and say, yes, sir, whatever you say, even though you made up your own rules. But by the way, I got to say one thing. Phil, you may have some thoughts about this as well. Today I'm reading the Toronto Star. The second time I've read this idea, it says about this Vic Toews thing. The Twitter. And they say, well, you know, this is so bad. Personal things have been brought up. And they say, and this is a Star defending Mr. Toews. And they say they themselves were in possession of this information. But they said, there's nothing criminal here. It's just personal stuff. And we don't do that. See, we don't indulge it because we're on a higher level. So, okay. Was he not here when they took down Jambroni?
Right.
A social democrat, the best shot the people of Toronto had to have a mayor, and he got taken down on gossip and dirty stories, and we got to look at his harsh. And none of that involved criminality. Any kind, he was an honest guy, a smart guy, but they decided that he was in the way of their candidate. So they took him down. So, you know, when they start dressing up and saying, oh, by the way, we're virgins, baloney. You know, this is the, you know, these guys are still licking the blood off their paws. So we shouldn't be treated to that kind of stuff. Anyway, look, hey, it's a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And check us out. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And we're on the web, Taylor-Report.com. Carol, thank you very much. Phil, thank you. And we'll see you all next week.